It is Saturday, November 27th, 2010, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today on GeekSpeak, geek news in the second half, your questions and comments about technology.
The bandwidth for GeekSpeak.org is provided by GNI, GNIHosting.com.
It's time now for GeekSpeak. GeekSpeak is a Creative Commons endeavor. You can share and share alike as long as you let people know about us. If you'd like to participate by making a theme song like Al Luckow did on this theme, please do so by giving us an email at geekspeak.org. Join the car guys, click and clack the Tappet brothers for their advice on things automotive and everything else. On Car Talk, every Sunday at 9 a.m. right here on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. GeekSpeak on KUSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. Welcome to GeekSpeak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during GeekSpeak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today we'll be doing some geek news in the second half. We'll invite you to participate. You're welcome to give us a call with questions and comments about technology. The phone numbers are 1-800-655-5877 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Lots of numbers there. We'll start out with Mr. Miles Elam. He's a software engineer and political junkie. Good morning, Miles.
Good morning.
Thanks for covering for me last week. I've been busy, as you can tell from my lack of...
Did you listen to the show? I'm not sure you'd be thanking me for that.
I listened to all for the first 15 minutes. It was beautiful. It's technically hard, you know? Difficult thing. What's your first news story, man?
The U.S. Patent and Trademark Office has sent Facebook a notice of allowance of a trademark that Facebook has submitted to them. They now own...
A trademark or a patent?
A trademark.
Okay.
They now own a trademark to the word face. So if you have something like, you know, they were selling shoes, face shoes.
Wait, no, who gave them a trademark? Not the, you said the patent office, didn't you mean?
Yeah, the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office.
I didn't know it was the same office. In what areas do they own? Because normally trademarks represent certain areas of, so if I'm going to sell shoes, for example, I can have the trademark. Flatties, but that doesn't cover balloons.
Online, you know, telecommunication services and computing. Yeah.
So anything online?
Yeah. Well, something that it focuses on online as opposed to some brick and mortar store where...
For like, I don't know, makeup, for example.
Exactly. Exactly.
Okay, so basically
although
you can't
it'd be
do an online
it'd be curious
service
if
with
Facebook started selling makeup and then...
And they will eventually. Just like Apple settled out. Apple Corporation settled out their issue with the company that owned the Beatles' work by saying, we'll never do music. And then, of course, they did do music. And then there was this lawsuit. And then finally, that was resolved. And that's why the Beatles actually showed up last week on iTunes.
Yeah, we're Apple. Oh, wait, no, we're going to be selling music. So we're now Apple Computer Incorporated. Mm-hmm. They actually changed their name from Apple to Apple Computer.
Oh, is that why they added the computer?
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. And then they removed computer.
Right. And then they took away the computer and just said Apple. And then they got into hot water with the Apple label.
Yeah. Yeah.
And at the same time, people were going, wait, has the Apple label even released anything lately?
Ever? I mean, just for years?
And then it finally became, I'm sure, the Apple label going, oh, you mean we could make more money again?
A lot more money again.
And you have,
like, pay us. And Apple's like, and I'm sure Apple, the computer company, is like, well, why don't we just put your music on the store and you'll make lots of money?
And an entire legion of hippies goes, gotta buy the White Album again.
Okay, so does that mean, so that means all social, all online stuff no face in it. We can't be Geek Speak Face.
Right.
Okay.
Good. Face Your Geek, yeah.
Because I was going to change the name, too. What about using it as not as a noun, but as a verb? Can you do that? Wait, is it a verb or a noun in their name?
Well, it depends. If you're playing, like, face, for example, when I was playing basketball back when I was younger, I was, or something like that.
In when your you
face. You know, face. You got faced. Yeah.
Yeah, you're so hip, man. Can't stand it.
I am so hip, you can barely see over my pelvis.
It's true. It's totally true. Okay, so no more use of face in anything. I gotta move this mic. I can't see your face. Oh, no. I'm in trouble now. All right. And now I'm going to go to Miles. You have a news story?
I was reading a very interesting article talking about DNSSEC. DNS, the domain name service, is how we are able to use the internet on the web. That's how most people use it without even thinking about it. When you type in www.geekspeak.org, or actually we don't use the www, do we?
It works.
Geekspeak.org, you are using DNS, even though you're going, well, you're just using a website, right? The only way you can get to our website is through a set of IP addresses, is this number, internet phone number, for lack of a better term. Mm-hmm. And so you type in geekspeak.org, and you go to our DNS server, and it says, oh, hey, geekspeak.org refers to this IP address. And then your browser makes a connection, your computer makes a connection to that IP address, and mm-hmm. then you get our wonderful site. DNSSEC is an answer to the problem of DNS. You know, problem of
what's
DNS?
What's the problem?
DNS is notoriously insecure. Many problems that we have online with regard to phishing attacks and like are due to security problems within DNS.
For example, shall I do one?
Sure.
You can, if you're on the same network as someone and they've asked for, hey, I need to know what machine geekspeak.org is, you can respond very quickly to that response, faster than the DNS server they're requesting, and potentially inject where the location would be. And then your browser would go to the wrong place.
Right. Now, to put that in perspective, say it's someone on the same network, what does that mean? You go to a coffee shop and you sign on to the free Wi-Fi that's at that coffee shop. You are now on the same network as everyone else who is surfing that free Wi-Fi.
And anyone basically would redirect you anywhere they wanted.
Right. So if you go to www.amazon.com and they're looking for that, they can respond back with amazon.com is this IP address. And it's what's called a race condition, where that person in the coffee shop is trying to get the answer back before the legitimate DNS server gets the answer back.
Right. But of course, in a traffic site, a site like that, it is so easy to slow down the network traffic and be the fastest thing on the network that responds to DNS, that it's dumb simple.
Especially if you're going over a congested wireless network.
Right, right. Yeah. And of course, if you're not going over a congested wireless network and you have someone in the same room with you, they can make it congested really fast.
Yeah.
So it's not...
So
SEC, so I'm assuming problem, stands for secure?
Yes. Security extensions. And the idea behind that is much the same difference between HTTP and HTTPS. In other words, when you go to Amazon.com and you're going to check out, you know, you're going to buy some item, you have that little padlock. Maybe your address bar at the top turns gold. That's another good indicator.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll have some little icons that says like, oh, this is Amazon Corporation, blue or green badge. And what that does is not just encrypts your communication, but it ensures that you are in fact talking to Amazon.com. DNSSEC is doing the same thing for DNS, which says not only are you getting back the answer, but there is a cryptographic signature on it that says this is indeed the answer from
your
the server that you're supposed to be getting it from.
Right. And I'm assuming that when you send the request, you send some information. I mean, it's very similar to HTTPS? More technical, huh?
No, it's not. It's doing a cryptographic signature rather than an actual encrypted conversation. It doesn't matter that someone sees, you know, which IP address you're getting. It's just a matter to know that you are getting the authoritative answer. That's more of what DNSSEC is going for. Now, the conversation that's going on, getting back to the original topic, was most people were thinking this is a wonderful technology. And I actually do believe that it's a wonderful technology. Some ISPs like Comcast are putting in pilot projects. And if you are a geek, I highly recommend that you jump on and start working out the details for it. The issue then comes if you can say, oh, this is an authoritative source and we control the authoritative source, the signed source, if you mm-hmm. will, then it also leads for governments to be able to provide a new form of censorship.
How so?
Right now, DNS is a bit harder to control because of those security issues that, mm-hmm. That we talked about. They can be used for good or ill. Like if some government says, oh, we're going to take away the DNS, like, okay, you put up another DNS server and you're done. If, however, you're going through a certificate setup where right. you're doing cryptographic signatures and
somebody
you can go to
the
legitimate source, the legitimate issuer of that DNS, for example, or you go to the Internet, which hands out all, it has the final say on all of them, and says, do not give out any authenticity access or give any signatures for this site or redirect them to some government black hole, you know, mm-hmm. some type of thing like that, then you essentially block off all access. Yes, the person could put in the IP address, but how often do you remember the phone number to everything like your plumber? No, right. you go to the phone book and look it up, sure. or you have it in your phone, or you look it up somewhere. DNS is that lookup process. So if you control the lookup process, you control the access.
Yeah, interesting. So it's interesting because, of course, the Wild West aspect of the internet, that aspect that put up your own stuff, make it all work kind of thing, that makes it so fluid and dynamic and open and, mm-hmm. and lack of control and a lot of spam. All these things are connected together, right? Is inherently, the way it's built right now, is inherently really insecure.
The internet was not made with security in mind, and security yeah. has been put on top of it. Yeah.
As we put in that security, can't we keep that wonderful freedoms that we have from the internet?
Here you're not getting into a technical problem. The technical problem has been solved. Essentially been solved. DNSSEC has solved that. What you're dealing with now is a political or social issue, which is something that technology has been horrible at solving. Technology doesn't solve social issues. People solve social issues.
Okay, I get that. But at the same time, couldn't there be a socially more pleasant solution to this problem?
Sure. People get more politically involved and make sure that their representatives don't pass laws that allow
restrict
to,
yeah. the access. Interesting.
That's for countries that even allow that type of that feedback to your government as opposed to a monarchy or a dictatorship.
Right. So, earlier in the month, November 10th or so, Apple made an announcement that they'd be discontinuing their server hardware. So Apple, we all know...
The X-Serve.
They release MacBooks, MacBook Pros, Power Macs, which is kind of the tower. Everyone called them G5s, but really they're not G5 processor anymore. And then, of course, the iMac and the Mac Mini. Those are the product line. They've also have this server, which is called the X server and X-Serve? I think it's just X-Serve. X-Serve.
Yeah, a 1U rack mount server.
That means it's an inch and, what is it, a U, an inch and a quarter, inch and a half?
I believe it's an inch and a quarter, and it's 19 inches wide.
Wide. I need the 19 inches wide, yeah. So this thing, basically the reason why you want a computer that's configured to mount into a rack of equipment is that you want to have a high density. And so server rooms that we've talked about a lot on GeekSpeak over the years are basically very cool, environmentally controlled, nice, stable power, really good network rooms that have a whole bunch of computers. And to pack computers in, you don't want tables with a whole bunch of computers on top of them. Even the Mac Minis pack pretty well. You want to have these racks that you can have the airflow go through them really cleanly and therefore eliminate any waste and cool your system efficiently.
Yeah, and rack mount systems in general tend to have very large fans at redundant power supplies, things that you don't need on your desktop computer. Because it would be like a jet engine at all times going in your room, which doesn't work.
And the other thing about a server such configuration like this, an X-Serve, when you have one of these, you do have redundant power supplies. That means if one of your power supplies fails, which is one of the things that happens on computers, they fail. I mean, the parts give out, capacitors blow, the whole deal. You can actually pull one of these power supplies and put another one in without the machine ever going down. So you really have this kind of stable level of access for a server, which you need because a lot of people rely on that the server that you're dealing with.
Right. So, you also end up with this very loud...
Yeah. And I had an X-Serve in my office for about a week while I was configuring it. Man, those things are loud. So Apple stopped making it. And it does make sense because there's a lot of server manufacturers out there. Apple's now doing Intel hardware. There's nothing really different about their product except that it's expensive. And it can run OS X. Now, that's the big thing is that Apple is really... OS X server. Apple's really resistant to letting their technology... run on any other hardware. Miles, you going to say
I was going to say the X-Serve, when it was first released, had a PowerPC processor in it.
That's true.
And it worked well in the 1U format. It's become less popular as time has gone on as it gets the Intel processor and components start getting hotter.
Right.
The PowerPC processor was great with regard to cooling.
But there are some features that you want in a server environment that are Apple specific. And that's the thing that you can't, like, normally if I were to set up a web server or, you know, a lot of service technologies that I'd be setting up, I'd want to go ahead and put it on a Linux distribution. And therefore, the hardware is really about the price point and, you know, efficiency, not about the Apple brand, for example. So they're going to lose in the Linux environment, in my opinion. But in a Macintosh environment where you want to have something like Final Cut Server, I think that's what it's called, Media Server, can't remember what it is. There are some server technologies that run only on Apple products. You want a server in your environment to do that. And that's so it's relatively easy. I host a few at work. I host a few OS X servers. And using a Macintosh with an OS X server connected and doing remote directories and stuff, this is really easy to do and fun to do as an administrator. But I can't. Yeah.
Well, the reason why I brought up the heat issues is because they made the Xserve 1U, this 1.25-inch tall format, and it worked well at first glance. But then as they started adding features, as they started having to deal with their different cooling issues, they ended up getting longer and longer. So they're 19 inches wide, that's because it fits into a standard rack, and 1.25 inches tall, because that's 1U, a 1U unit. And so the only place they have to grow is backwards. So what you're finding now with folks that have a cabinet that has an Xserve and other machines is that the Xserve pokes out so much further than the other ones that it becomes an issue trying to figure out, like, how do you fit it in correctly.
It's definitely it's very deep server. So in a hardware perspective, Apple's been basically kind of failing in the Xserve. And that's the thing that's frustrating for someone that administers a lot of Macintosh environment. You want to have an OS X server running. That's a convenient thing to do. But Apple restricts you and says you can run, and even they've even opened up virtualization, so you can have multiple OS X server instances on one piece of hardware. But you've got to have an Apple hardware to run it, which is really frustrating. So with the loss of the OS X server to the market, there's this open letter at appleopenletter.org that's to Steve that basically says, okay, fine, you're not going to make servers anymore. Then let us install OS X on other platforms. And I don't know if Apple's responded to this. But
they're probably going, buy a mini.
Exactly. That's the thing. Apple's solution is buy a mini or buy a Power Mac. Those are both, you know, and put them on a shelf. It's like, that's just not really a solution for a server environment.
So, because they don't have the redundant power supplies. They don't bolt into a rack the same way. I guess you could jerry-rig something. But when you're building a server environment, you don't want to jerry-rig.
No,
you want to have things that just...
You want to have the redundant power supply, and you want to have the hard drives that are hot swappable. These are important things.
Yeah, that was one of the things also is that they used to have 4 hard drives for the RAID, but because of the heat issues, they had to put in an extra fan and cooling system, so you lost one of them, so there became only 3 drives.
Yeah,
that's why
Sad.
That happened.
Sad. Anyway,
but
they
could have gone to 2U, but maybe they wouldn't have been as pretty.
Yeah, I don't know why they didn't do that. I mean, I get the price.
Because the Xers have always been pretty.
They have been pretty. But they're no more. You're up, sir.
So a general note to medical practitioners out there, when you are sending radioactive medical material, things that are used for tracking, you know, or, you know, things like that.
You're talking about like when you take an isotope and you inject it into a human body
right.
so that you can then, with the scanning technology, see better where things are flowing.
Right. Or you have something that's just as a background radiation that you can use as a film to be able to photograph items. Medical technology has a lot of radiation in use for various purposes, and it has advanced the study of medicine.
Both ionizing and non-ionizing radiation.
Right. In general... highly recommended that if you were transporting this material that you don't send it by FedEx, which is what happened recently when a shipment of radioactive rods used in medical equipment was being sent from North Dakota to Tennessee and didn't make it to its destination.
Whoops.
FedEx is going back and trying to find out where it was dropped off at, and they are notifying every place, not just the places that were the correct stop-off points, but every place that could be in the chain in case it was dropped off in the wrong spot. But at the same time, who are these people that are in the medical industry that are saying, FedEx, That's a good idea.
Well, well, is this stuff dangerous?
Yeah. If someone opens it, doesn't know what it is, and kind of just has it sitting out on their table for a couple of days, they could get sick. They could suffer from radiation poisoning. It's not enough radiation where, you know, their skin's going to be sloughing off like immediately, but it's the type of thing where, yeah, they could get sick.
Thank you, Miles, for that image. I'm assuming this thing's encased in something that reduces the amount of radiation.
Well, the container, yes. The container is shielded.
Okay. And I bet the shielded container says, danger, Will Robinson, danger.
I'm sure that it does.
Yeah.
At the same time, have you seen Jackass before? I mean, people do
stupid things.
Stupid things.
So how do you suggest that they send this stuff?
By courier? As a specific item? You
Miles,
send someone,
general rule number 72, when you are shipping radioactive material,
don't
send
use
somebody
FedEx.
With it.
Yeah, yeah.
That just means more radiation for that one person, though.
Not if it's in the container.
Okay. Here's a 500-pound item you need to carry across the states.
But you send it through a special service, one specializes in...
How often does FedEx lose a package?
Sensitive material.
Do you have any idea from this article to talk about that? How often do they actually lose packages?
Oh, who knows? I mean, lose curious. Packages permanently? I don't know. Lose packages temporarily? Quite often.
Daily. It's kind of how their process works. They kind of leave it places, and it's kind of lost for a while.
Yeah, you look at the tracking thing, it's like, it's been sitting in the Texas warehouse for 3 days.
No, I like the one that says it's been in transit for seven days in transit from Texas to Arizona. It's like, why? Was it going by snail?
By our modern rail system, actually.
Same thing. All right.
Yeah, fun fact. If you were to take a train 100 years ago, you would arrive at your destination, if you're going from like LA to Sacramento, you would arrive at your destination faster 100 years ago than you would today, on average.
Wow. Wow. Why?
The average
speed's not the issue?
Passenger rail just doesn't have a priority.
There are some. What are those things that go in the air?
Oh, airplanes?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Use up a lot more fuel. And
you know, I've got a story, but it's a... It's not newsworthy. It's not geeky worthy, but it's why I've been missing so many Geek Speaks. I'm in a show, Miles. Did you know?
I heard something about that. Is it your normal hack job?
No, it's not my normal hack job. It's my super hack job. No, I'm doing. It's a fun show, and we're up.
It's a family tradition.
It's a family tradition show. That's right. It's we've been Miracle on 34th Street at Park Hall in Ben Lomond. If you'd like to come see the show, I'm in it. Come afterwards. I'll talk geek with you after the show.
Your father was in it before he passed.
My father and my parents helped write it.
Your daughter is in it?
Yep. My son's in it. It's amazing. It's a whole family affair. But we opened last night, and it was a blast. And but what I want to talk about the technologies, I've been sewing for 4 days, making elf costumes. And I got to say, sewing machines are fantastic. Have you ever like spent a lot of time with a sewing machine?
As a matter of fact, Becca was looking for a sewing machine, and my mother provided my grandmother's old sewing machine.
What year is it? Like 40s?
No, it's only a 60s. It's one that she bought. It wasn't one that she had when she was a child. It was one that she bought after the fact, but it was still, you know, it's a good piece of equipment.
Yeah, a friend came over and brought a 1940s sewing machine, and you could tell it was, you know, one of the first that could plug in, and it was beautiful. And I said, so did you get it serviced? She's like, no, never had it serviced. Like, what? This is a very complicated machine. It just lasts and lasts and lasts.
If you're not using plastic parts like plastic gearing.
So the one I'm using.
They last a while.
The one I'm using going through a thick spot and a broken needle. It just happens. And it didn't really cover after that. And I opened up, because we had a lot of fuzz and fur and it was everywhere. Opened up the gears, plastic gears. I'm like, oh, this will not be around for 40 years. Or, gosh, 60 years like the other one. So anyway, sewing machine's pretty awesome. We're going to have to
do a show.
But
probably would be quieter, though. Plastic gears tend to be quieter.
It was very quiet. It was the one I was using was the quietest one in the room, and it was all computer controlled. So it was interesting. Like most of the sewing machines, you're using dials and stuff to set them, and if you depower them and power them back up, they're in the same settings. The one I was using, anytime I power cycled it, it would reset, and I'd have to set all the settings again.
Oh, see, that's a bug.
I think so too. Yeah, totally. It was really interesting to see the feature set that it had. Like in the sewing, you know, when you want to pull your piece of fabric out of the machine, you've got to lift your needle and your foot. So the foot's almost always manual. But in this one I was using, every time you stopped, it continued the stroke down until it hooked the bobbin line. And the reason for that, I'm assuming, is so that the needle would be stuck in. So if you did lift the foot, you could rotate the piece of work. You didn't have to spin it yourself. Mm. You'd always set it that way. And if you wanted to raise the needle, you pushed a button and it went, did a half stroke up to the top to release let go of the fabric.
I'm still kind of stuck really on cool that whole, wait a second, how much data is going to be in there? Like, a 4K module should be able to hold all the settings that they would ever need to do. And yet,
this thing had a lot.
There's no reason for it not to save state.
No, it should totally save state. You're right. Absolutely. It's ridiculous. Saving state meaning that if you turn it off and you turn it back on, why isn't it in the same settings? Totally. Well, they have higher.
It doesn't even need to be fast. Like a 4K module that's like super slow, meaning like it takes a second.
Dude, I think there was less than 60 patterns, so it's not a 4K. What do you need for that?
I'm talking about something really small.
Like, I know.
Like today we're talking about 4 gigabyte modules.
Yes.
And I'm talking about 4 kilobyte. In other words, 1 million times smaller than your typical flash drive.
All right, sewing machine.
That costs like $7.
You could start working on that. I think the higher models probably have that. The other thing is these machines now.
Upsell you for $15 to get a 4K module.
That's right. You know, it was more like $50. You want your sewing machine to save the state? How do you market that to somebody?
This one remembers settings.
That's good. That's good. I like that. GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by the new high school project at Chartwell, a project-based college preparatory high school designed to unwrap each student's potential. Host an evening open house Tuesday, November 30th from 4 p.m. to 7 p.m. More info online at newhighschool.org or 393-8004. And since I mentioned phone numbers, the phone number here is 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. You can ask us any questions you'd like. We'd be happy to help you out. In the air with me is Miles Elam.
Good morning.
And I'm Lyle Troxell. Yeah, we didn't do that at the top of the show.
What are you talking about?
I didn't introduce you.
Yeah, you did.
Did I?
Yeah.
You didn't say hello.
Yes, I did.
Okay, let's rewind. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP. The phone number is, again, to ask us anything you'd like. Rick is standing by. 1-800-655-5877. I'm still only doing one phone number, but I keep on saying the phone numbers. It's technically lots of numbers. There's an 800, a 655, and then a 5,877. GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. Do you have a favorite sewing machine? Give a call. Let us know. I'd love to hear. Miles, another news story, sir, while we're waiting for calls.
It's so many to choose from. It was a great week for news. Google is introducing new meta tags for news authors. The idea being there that a news author can put in this meta tag and then someone who else who copies it, for example, and pulls it from an RSS feed, for example, would have that meta tag as well, and you give authorship back to whoever originally wrote the story.
We need like a little, hold on a second there, sir. What's meta? What's a meta tag?
Meta in general, the prefix refers to one level up information. So meta information is information about information. A meta tag is information about the information present in a markup document, like HTML or RSS. And one of the big deals actually has been a blogger would say, hey, here's this information, but they won't cite who the original source is, or you'd end up with like one blogger points to another blogger who points to another blogger who points to the original story. And the idea here is Google is introducing a tag so that a responsible blog author, anyway,
mm-hmm.
would be able to cite reference the source, who the original source was.
Nice.
And not just...
And the idea would be that would propagate along. So even if I read it 4 stages back, I'd still be able to link right to the original source.
Right. There'd be some mechanisms for being able to associate credit. At the same time, now we're going to hear a whole new generation of journalists talking about, hey, have this blogger and I have my meta tag and they're not giving me credit. And so we'll see that aspect. But there's a step now in this technical direction. We're not solving the social problem. We're solving the technical problem.
It's really funny. RSS, the real simple syndication, was really simple syndication. It didn't have the complications in there. And slowly it's growing with meta tags, it sounds like, to make it work at a level that we needed it now.
And it's growing with stuff like the social web to put in semantic tags.
Yep.
They're going to
be pretty well-formed, interesting documents.
Everything gets more complex.
Everything?
Yeah.
Not love, baby.
The cars of 1950s required a lot more maintenance than the cars of today. The cars of today will run longer in general.
Sewing machines.
At the same time, they are more complex.
It's true.
More and more, you can't get underneath the hood and fix a problem in your car.
No, not without a computer. All right, Mary from Woodruff, Wisconsin. Welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi, thanks. I have two questions. They both pertain to the iPad and the iPhone.
Mm-hmm.
The first one is, can you get a virus on your iPad or iPhone?
Currently, no, but technically, yes.
Well, is it possible to? Yes. Has it been an issue so far? No.
Has anyone gotten one? No.
Okay, because I got one of the, I was on my iPad and was on Safari and got one of those, you know, things where it says, you know, your computer's infected and they want you to click on a thing. And
That's like someone posting in a newspaper, posting an ad that says your computer is infected. It has no actual relevance to the physical hardware. It's merely an advertisement.
It just looks good. It's kind of like if you got a if you got a little thing that looked like it came from the post office department that said your mailbox is infected, and it really was somebody else sending something to you.
Yeah. On the bright side, because you're on an iPad or an iPhone, you won't get infected by the malware that usually comes associated with that. Usually people will see your computer is infected. They click on it, and by them clicking on it, it infects their Windows machine with a virus.
But that won't
happen. Or with a piece of malware.
But that won't happen on your iPad because it can't run the code.
Yeah, that's kind of what I thought.
You have a second question?
Yeah, the next question has to do with magnets. My husband has a name tag that has a magnet. That's how it's hooked onto his shirt. And he stores his iPhone basically next to that magnet. Is that okay to do?
Yeah, as long as it doesn't scratch the surface of the iPhone.
Okay.
For permanent storage, it's probably not a big deal. It's not a big deal for flash, but you don't want to have a strong magnet next to an electromagnetic device like a computer while it's running. I could see a magnet causing some disruption.
Not to the electronics. The only thing that might be damaging is to the speaker system and the microphone.
Well, it's not damaging. I was actually thinking more along the lines of causing crashes. Because you're flipping bits.
No, a magnet's not going to flip a bit. No way.
Okay, I'm wrong.
Not unless it's moving real quick or something. But,
the motion. Sorry, never mind. Sorry.
The only concern I'd have has to do with inside the iPhone are... Actually, those are probably not... No, you're totally safe. There's no...
It's not like having a hard drive next to it. It's a different type of technology.
I guess the one thing is the iPhone does have a compass in it. Therefore, there's a magnetically sensitive device. But I bet you anything that thing is designed to be in a situation that it can take a lot more power of magnetic force, if you will, from than just a little magnet's holding your name tag on. You're totally safe.
Oh, yeah. A magnet holding a name tag on, that's going to be so...
I mean, it could be one of those really strong, you know, super strong ones. But no, I think you're
still
totally fine.
You're still dealing with the inverse square law. Like, that's still...
Yeah, the reason why at some point there was a concern about magnets and computers really has to do with the magnetic material in the computer, right? So the original floppy drives, if you took a floppy drive and you ran it past a magnet, you could erase content from it.
You would erase.
Yeah. Well, except for a static magnet, pretty hard to do. I mean, you'd have to move it pretty quickly.
No, you just by drawing the magnet, touching it to it, you would.
We had this
would.
Great machine. When we used to do reel-to-reel here at the station at KSB here, we used to have this great machine that could erase tape. Because you take a reel-to-reel, you want it to be blank so that in case you had a space or didn't
record. The bulk erasers, yeah.
Yeah, so it was this thing that you'd push a button and it would go, and you'd spin around. And I remember one time pretending that I had one of my dad's floppies and brought it over there and was like, does this work on this? Because I had a blank one. And he's like, Anyway, you're fine now. The technology, I don't even think you could damage it. I'm almost positive.
Yeah, we gave you the long answer. The short answer is it's fine.
You're fine.
So the iPad too would be fine. Because I have these little speakers that they hold together with a magnet. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they're just sitting right on top of my iPad.
Yep, no problem.
So, great.
Yeah, the biggest thing is don't scratch it. That's about it.
Yeah, exactly.
Thanks for calling.
Okay, great. Thanks for your help.
Everybody.
Bye-bye.
That was Mary from Wisconsin.
Yeah, I would think if it was going to cause a problem, the first thing you'd see would be like the iPad or the iPhone would reboot randomly or something like that. And that's long before, I mean, and it doesn't happen.
Yeah, yeah. from Santa Cruz, Glenn, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi, how are you guys?
Quite well.
So listening to your sewing machine tale, it reminded me, I think it was the very first home computer application that I'm aware of was 1976, and I made a computerized loom for his wife.
Oh, cool.
With his Altair computer.
Nice.
The first kit computer. And, boy, that goes way back, doesn't it, to, you know, the first looms, the first punch cards were developed in order to run looms back in the 90s. Century.
Yeah, in fact, there's a lot of interconnections between the technology and computer age and the textile industry. The first computers were wired together by people that did weaving because there's so much wire that you need to be able to keep track of it. And people that could do really good, you know, weaving had the skills necessary to make the first computers. There's a wonderful connection between textiles and
the computers. No longer steam powered as much anymore. But yeah,
that's true.
That's too bad, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know about it being too bad. I personally like the fact that there's no coal dust around where I'm working.
Or people losing arms and giant belts that come from the ceiling for the power. Yeah, that's a great flashback. And, in fact, these new sewing machines do, a lot of them have USB ports where you plug them in your computer, you can give it a pattern, and it will spit out a whole embroidery system, an image.
Wow.
But they're not totally cheap, but they're kind of fun to play with. And the thing is, the ones that are cheap enough to get for home aren't going to last because they have these plastic wheels on them, right? So you need the more expensive ones. I've been trying to research that for work to be able to have more abilities to take stuff from the virtual environment of a computer and make it a physical object.
I was thinking all the wonderful things, all the combinations you can make with an Arduino and a set of servos.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
Miles got to come by the office sometimes. People are doing some amazing, students are doing some amazing robotic stuff with Arduinos. Hey, thank you, Glenn, for the call.
You're welcome.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye. We're now speaking with Bob from Watsonville. Welcome to GeekSpeak, Bob. Oh, if you'd like to call in, the phone numbers are 1-800-655-5877. Hi, Bob.
Hi. Yeah, I have an HP DV8000, and I'm kind of new to the understanding the operating system, but as far as I can understand, the registry's corrupted because it won't open the executable files. So I got the registry mechanic. I bought that and downloaded it, and it said it fixed 1,400 glitches. And now, of course, when I try and click on a program like iTunes or Firefox, it says the file doesn't have a program associated with it for performing the action. So kind of
was that through. Would that problem happen before you ran the registry mechanic?
Then it would open up a dialog box. It would say, here's a list of programs. What do you want to open it with? And, of course...
No, it doesn't do that.
Right.
So, when the registry first arrived to us geeks played with it every once in a while, and it was always a scary thing. And over time, I got more and more comfortable with it. But it's always been a bit of a black box voodoo thing for me. Miles, what do you feel about the registry?
Oh,
do you like
HP
playing with
local
it?
Machine, thou art a savage mistress. Yeah, for geeks out there, everyone will go like, oh, yeah, and everyone else is left going,
it's part
what?
Of the registry. It's yeah. how you address the machine. In the, registry.
The local user yeah. information, yeah.
I'm not familiar with Registry Mechanic. Are you, Miles?
No, I'm not, but the fact that it was asking you for an application before you ran Registry Mechanic and now it's saying no application is registered with it seems to me like there may have been something done like add remove programs and a useful program was removed.
It's also possible that just the mapping was removed and you could actually do a right click on the file that you want to open mm-hmm. and you should see an open with command on the right hand side mm-hmm. and then navigate to the object, the application you want to use. And then at the bottom of that dialog box, before you say okay, there should be a little checkbox saying always use this application
uh-huh.
and that's going to remap it for you. You can actually go into the view settings. Are you an XP, I'm assuming?
Yes.
Yeah. The other thing you could do, and I think that I would recommend this at this point, is to reinstall the operating system. Well, should I recommend that? If you reinstall the operating system, you won't have this problem anymore.
Yeah, with great results comes great risk. many times you can reinstall the operating system just over itself, and any missing programs and DLLs will come back. But there's also a risk that you do that, and the system becomes unusable.
Yeah.
So it's hard for us to recommend it, even though it probably what we would do.
Right.
Right. Won't I lose everything on my desktop, though, all the files? And
not necessarily. That's the risk. It could either win big or lose big.
But the thing I would do before doing that is making sure you have a good double backup. So you have a backup like you normally should have, just to give good computer use. I always have a backup that's always running. And then for this situation, when you're actually going to install an operating system, what I would do is I would go into your user folder, mm-hmm. And that's under, Miles, can you help me out here?
Documents and settings.
Documents and settings.
My documents is what
My documents, yeah. You want to go into the C drive and find the My Documents folder inside Documents and Settings and copy that entire folder to an external hard drive, a USB drive of some sort, or a network share or something. Copy that whole thing. And if there are errors in that copy, make sure you understand why those errors are happening and make sure you're also not running any applications when you do this, especially like Outlook, if you use Outlook. So moving all that stuff over and then reinstall your operating system, understanding that even doing the best practice possible, you might be losing data. And that's why you also have a backup somewhere. And then when you're done with that, you can migrate over that content from the external drive using, what's it called? Assistant? I can't remember.
Oh, the backup assistant?
Backup assistant? Windows? No, there's a user migration.
I'm actually
Windows.
Not too
I know, me neither.
Fond of that one. There are actually several free Windows backup applications. If you Google for free Windows backup, there are several of them to choose from, and a lot of them are pretty good.
Yeah. Okay. It's time to take some time with it, though. Sorry.
All right. Thanks for the information.
Certainly, Bob. Take care.
Bye-bye.
And from San Jose, Justin, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hey, how you doing, guys?
Quite well. Unfortunately, Ben's not here with us today, and I think Ben would be a better answer to your question, but go ahead and ask anyway.
Okay, well, it's great to be on the show. My question was, on my first generation Android, I frequently am addicted to surfing the web on forums and whatnot, but some websites can recognize that I'm a mobile phone, which they lock down some of the, you know, the yes. full site features. Is there a way around that?
Yeah, there are. What kind of mobile phone do you have?
The Droid first generation.
All right. So when you're navigating the web, your browser that you're using is actually sending information every time it requests a page. So how it happens is, let's say you want to go to geekspeak.org. Your browser gets together a package and says, excuse me, geekspeak.org, this is the kind of browser I am, and that's called the user agent, and I want to do this. And then the server responds with content. And it can look at the user agent, the thing that the browser defines itself as, and do different things. And one of the things it will do for a mobile device to try to help you is give you an experience that's better for a mobile device. But the Android and the iPhone both have such a complete browser inside there. If no one does that, you can still use the site pretty effectively. So sometimes you want to disable that feature. To do it is kind of a hack, but there's easy ways to do it. You basically want to edit your user agent. And I bet you there's an app on the Android that does that. Would you think, Miles?
There are definitely several apps that can do that. It's just a question of hunting them down. They're going to be very small. They're very simple programs.
Right. So basically it's called a user agent. Just look for an app that does user agent editing. And install that, and then you can say, I'm Firefox or I'm Windows, you know, Netscape 4 if you want.
Every time, or is that just like a hands-off approach and it will just do it run by itself?
I'm not sure how the app's going to work. I'm assuming what would happen is you would take the URL and you would go to this app and run it, and the app would look like your browser, but it would do the slight change. It could be a plugin. It depends on how Android's browser plugin technology works, if they have plugins for their Android
phone. Unfortunately, our guy who has an Android phone could speak to us from personal experience here today.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you, Justin.
Well,
yes?
I have a follow-up question real quick.
Sure.
Is there an alternative that you know to the Google Marketplace on the Android that...
Again, this is a great question for Ben. I'm so sorry. No, yes, there's hundreds of different places to get apps than the Google Marketplace. In fact, that was a news story a while back that the Google Marketplace is not the only place. But it's not the default way to do it, if you will. But unfortunately, you know what you could do if you'd like? You're welcome to go to our website, geekspeak.org, send a note to the geeks, just put Android in the subject, right? And Ben is going to jump on that. He loves talking about the Android phones.
Okay, great. I'll do that.
Thank you, Justin.
Hey, thanks a lot.
The phone numbers are 1-800-655-5877. You can ask us anything you'd like. Again, 800-655-5877. I'm Lyle Troxell. We also have Miles Elam in the house. And Rick is answering phones today. From Correlatus, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Yes, my name is Vigiano. And for the last two, I know I'm about 8 or 10 miles from the tower. So sometimes I don't get plugged into the internet. But it's, for the last 2 weeks, I haven't been able to get on at all. So I went over to a friend's house where I can also use my computer, and I couldn't get on the internet there either.
Are you on cable or satellite?
I'm on, a wireless.
Really? Who's your provider? What company is giving it to you?
I don't know. My daughter, AT&T.
AT&T?
I think so, yeah. My daughter buys it for me, so I don't really know for sure.
Yeah. And you have a laptop?
I have a laptop, yeah, and it's a new, it's fairly new.
And when you're at your friend's, is it a Macintosh or Windows laptop?
Windows.
Okay. See, what you have to do is you have to connect to their network. You have to choose that you want to connect to them. Were you able to do that?
What was that again?
You're going to have to connect to the wireless network that you want to have access to. You'll have to tell the computer to connect to that wireless access point.
Yeah, I was able to do it at her place before.
Okay, and I don't think it's something I can actually answer on the phone.
I'm assuming that when you say that it's through the AT&T wireless, it's a little card that plugs into your laptop?
No, I thought she had AT&T, but she may have changed over.
Unfortunately, I don't think we can really answer this question over the phone.
Without seeing the computer.
You want to kind of figure out, we have to ask a lot of questions and look at the machine while we're talking with you, and we're not going to do this on the radio, unfortunately.
Okay,
but I suggest asking your daughter who hooked it up with you to chat with you about it. If she's in a place where she's not sure what's going on, feel free to call back with a little bit more information and be great.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for calling.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Well, we don't have any more calls right now, which is kind of nice, actually, because there was a few more news stories I want to get to from your list. Do you mind just picking your favorite one?
Sure. An autonomous car, in other words, a car that drives itself, has been able to complete the Pikes Peak run successfully.
Whoa. How fast?
The typical human drivers, and these are good drivers. This is not your typical, I would not be surviving the drive. I'm sure I would fall off the cliff. Pikes Peak, if folks don't know, it's a 14,110-foot
climb and descent.
And a human driver typically takes around 17 minutes.
And this is someone driving very fast.
Right. This is someone who's a professional driver.
Pushing it to the limits.
Who knows what the course looks like and, is doing their utmost. This autonomous car, this robot car, if you will, took 27 minutes.
That's pretty good.
But at the same time, no human involved. It was able to navigate the course.
Completely? Like nobody was driving this vehicle?
Right. Completely autonomous.
Did it have a 3D map that it was using or was it doing it by sight? Do you know?
I would imagine there was a mixture of two, but
yeah. I mean, that kind of speeds though, you can't really rely on just doing everything exactly right. You've got to compensate.
Oh no, you have to see the road. Yeah. Google has been doing a lot with autonomous cars lately as well. This particular one was a Stanford University entry, but there's been a lot of work with autonomous cars that are able to actually navigate in traffic. We covered the story on Geekspeak a few weeks back or a month back. Where a car that was project funded by Google was able to navigate traffic in the Bay Area with an engineer just sitting in the passenger seat, whereas the car was doing all of the merging and turning and getting on and off the freeway.
Did that engineer have a wheel in front of him so he could compensate or something?
Yes.
I don't know how much...
I'm sorry, the engineer was in the driver's seat, but the engineer was not holding the wheel.
Right, okay, that's the way to do it.
It's
kind of scary. You know, it's really interesting when you talk about robotics. Having a robot that can do a simple pattern of steps is really not that complicated, right? You pre-program it, say, do this, do that, do this, and have it do it.
Mm-hmm.
No big deal. And for a long time, that's
anyone who has Lego Mindstorms is familiar with this.
And that's how automation's worked in the car industry, for example, for a long time. You know, it's always doing the same thing. But to get the robot to really deal with a real-world environment, you have to give it feedback. You have to start giving knowledge back to the system the entire time so it can do compensation.
You do a form of radar, which is like our eyes.
Right, right. And basically, the more information about the real world you're able to feed into the system and process, the better the system can then compensate for it. So that it can go ahead and drive on an open road and navigate a track and actually go fast. These are all a lot of complicated variables that it's got to be processing. Right. And of course, a car has a lot of space for computer power. But still, I'm wondering, you know, there's always that question about robots. We joke a lot about on this show that at some point the complication could get to a point where it's too complicated for us to understand. And it becomes to a level that it's getting enough input from the systems out and then compensating effectively that it's hard to distinguish.
Right.
If it's intelligence or not, for example.
There almost certainly will come a point where an autonomous car will be able to do Pikes Peak at or exceeding the human. Well, it depends. There's some drivers who are very good, and they may actually be hitting about the optimum in terms of the speeds, the braking, the turn angle, things like that, where a computer may not be able to get past that optimum. But you may end up with a situation where, because the car doesn't have to have a human being and deal with the safety aspects to it and that weight, mm-hmm. that a car that doesn't have a human being in it could go faster because it doesn't have to worry about,
right?
If I fall off the cliff, I'm going to kill someone. Well, give it a try.
Additionally, a car that doesn't have a human being doesn't have to be as tall, right?
Right.
You don't need a top. I mean, you can start really reducing. But the other thing is that the robotic car that could do it the same quality as the top human, they could do it over and over and over all day long and never have to rest.
Right.
Like, there's all those side effects.
And that's one of the things that Google is working on with regard to the car in traffic is the computer-controlled car doesn't worry about, doesn't get distracted by the radio, doesn't get, start singing along with the music on there.
It would definitely be safer in some sense.
Doesn't argue with the children in the back seat, things like that.
Doesn't have a coronary. I mean, doesn't have another problem with the body. Of course, a robot can break down. A machine can break down. So there is...
As can human beings. So there may come a point where it is safer having the computer drive the car than a human being.
I would say with the amount of deaths we have, it'd probably be safer right away. People might get there slower, but... GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by Home and Small Business Tech, providing IT support to businesses, tech support for home and computers. Home and Business Tech specialize in protecting data and have been providing data storage, recovery, virtualization, and maintenance for over 10 years. HASBtech.com. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP Santa Cruz. We're streaming and podcasting at KOSP.org. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of online tonight with David Lawrence and is used with permission. We thank the Puppet Master for its use. Mr. Miles Elam, would you like to fill in for Al Luckow's crazy USB of the week?
Oh, unfortunately, I don't have a crazy USB.
You have something down here that says, Miles, I have a USB thing if you want. And I bet that was Al last week saying he had one.
That was Al last week.
USB stands for Universal Serial Bus.
Oh,
and you can have power on it and it can do things.
Yeah. Crazy USB. USB is being kind of sidelined on the new MacBook Pros. There's rumors that it's going to be LightPeak.
They're going to be
getting rid of like FireWire and all those and DVI and DisplayPort and just having a LightPeak connector.
LightPeak optical?
Yes.
So does it also have a line on the side that does digital? It does power as well? Because the reason why we have so many crazy USB of the week is that USB has a nice clean power supply.
Yeah.
So anybody can plug it in, power supply. And the power supply is actually a lot of cost to these stupid little things people sell. So if you don't have to have a power supply, you just have a USB cable, it is a lot cheaper.
I believe they're working on a power rail for it, but I don't know any specifics because they were also looking at monitors, and those are bigger than in terms of power or a lot greater power requirement.
Right, right. Well, this has been Geek Speak on KUSP. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me was Miles Elam. Thanks for listening. Thanks for calling in. If you'd like to participate by creating content for our show, we'd love to have your music theme songs we'd play at the top of the hour. Please go ahead and contact us at geekspeak.org. Coming up next is Car Talk. Thanks for listening.